Okay, so, you know, it says in our fifth tradition that every AA group ought to be a spiritual entity. So let's spend 3 minutes in silence, just to bring us all back to together.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change, the courage to change the things that can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
So, my name's Jay Stennett, and I am a historian of the spiritual antecedents of this movement that we call Alcoholics Anonymous, and also a biographer of Bill Wilson. And current thing that I'm working on is a spiritual biography and of him. And it'll be, it's really been an amazing process. And how many people here have said, well, it really wasn't 100, it was only 78? Okay. The topic that we've got here, excuse me, could you pass me the our schedule says how the first 78 came to be. Okay? As in the first there were by inference there really weren't 100, there was only 78 when the big book came out. And that's one of those pieces for some folks that are rather interesting. It's part of this thing about, well, Bill was a promoter. He wasn't really, you know, he was fudging the numbers to make things work. And one of the reasons why I'm doing the biography that I'm doing is that I feel that he's pigeonholed into about a 3 to 5 year period, being sober 3 to 5 years, and that's the only credit and run that he really gets. And okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is from the foreword to the first edition. Evidently, there's a lot of people aren't familiar with this, but it says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body." That's the very first line in the preface to the first edition. So the argument here is that there really were not 100. Bill Wilson rounded it up by about a third, from 75 or so to 100.
I think that this topic is not of that much interest to the group. So we may make this really, really quick, okay? Since it's on here, we'll just say that this was general weirdness by the folks who put this thing together, and we'll go to some other topics. But one of the things that I've been fortunate enough to do is I created with my friend Bill Schaber from Fairfield, Connecticut, the Symposium on AA History. And starting in 2014, we annually get together with people that are doing primary research into the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're not stuck with, well, my sponsor told me that when blah, 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 that we're working with people that are using primary documents and doing primary research. And by that, it's only, you need two pieces of evidence that say exactly the same thing that are verifiable at the time, okay? And so, anyway, a couple years ago, we had our friend John Barton come out from New Jersey. He's an archivist in New Jersey, and he actually went through and collated all the data. And lo and behold, it was much more than what it was that, you know, there was at least 100 people. I've got the names. I've got their sobriety dates. They come from three separate lists of people. Doesn't seem to be something that's this big of a deal to this group, but, you know, with the sobriety dates, with all the different back and forth, they were able to verify by name, not numbers, by name, the first 100 people, that over 61 of them stayed sober from the gate, and another 13, after having a few drinks here and there, did indeed stay sober after that. So 2 out of 3. And so just to let you know that those numbers are indeed, there was one thing that was another interesting thing that he said, and one of the documents that he uses is that Bill Wilson had a first edition book that he wrote the person's name and their sobriety date in. And also on the back page, other people that came in, and he listed them as ones, twos, and threes. One is people that came and stayed sober. Two was people that came and had a couple of slips along the way, and three was what they called failures. So like Hank Parkhurst, the unbeliever in the first book, who was really the driving force behind the writing of the book. I mean, he was a co-founder of AA straightforward, but he drank in 1939 and never sobered again. So he was a failure. But in this, Bill says that he says, I've placed here as failures 5 who attended 3 or 4 meetings at most. So of this 100 people, he's counting as failures people who only attended a few meetings. These men, I feel, were exposed to our idea, did not take the treatment. If we leave those out, if we include only those who really tried the program for 3 months or more, our percentage of success climbs to 72.2%. 3 out of 4. Now, the thing that's interesting to me about that statement, what does he say is really trying? 90 days of going to meetings. Is that where going to 90 meetings in 90 days started? No, because they didn't have 90 meetings in 90 days. But 90 days being a shot at really being exposed to the thing for 90 days was really trying. Not having a sponsor, working the step, blah, blah, you know, all the wonderful things that I've said at different times. This is what really trying means. But anyway, so that's a little thing on the first 78. I don't think we need any more than that. Anybody got questions? Yeah.
Was there really 78 or was there 100?
There was 100. Yeah. You want the names? They're right here. No, I mean, that's it. There were 100. And if anybody's got a AA history question, I don't mean to seem irritated about that, but it's just one of those things that I'm sorry if we're not using the time to be more helpful to more people. But
what part in history did more women start going in and more people that weren't that
first
down in the gutter and drunk start being more openly coming in?
Well, the explosion. So the question was, when did Alcoholics Anonymous start to grow demographically? Okay, I would say that we could probably say about 1945 to 1948. 1948, after the Second World War. Well, actually, the most precise answer would be, the movement only starts to grow after Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post. And that blew the thing up nationwide, and it changed everything about the movement. But after the Second World War, you've got a huge, because a lot of people that were in the Army, they've gone back home, and then Alcoholics Anonymous is still getting into 1 or 2 major magazines a year. People are hearing more and more about it. The movie comes out. I don't know when the. I don't think. The Last Weekend comes out till about 55 or 58 with Ray Milland. But anyway, so the but I'd say after the Second World War is when it really blew up. We're from an area in Southern California where in 1948 there's probably 200 meetings just in a small area around Los Angeles.
I think the other thing you got to consider too, when you talk about when did it open up and it was more than just gutter drunks, the guys that founded this thing were not gutter drunks. You know, they were mostly white middle class professional guys.
That had drank their souls away.
That had drank their souls away. But you're not talking about guys off the Bowery. You know, it was very middle class, it was very white, and they had a real struggle of letting other people in, you know. We could get into some stories.
Well, I think my esteemed historian friend here, maybe the difference between Akron and New York in that is quite different than the folks that were coming in. But, yes, sir.
Kind of piggyback on what the friend said there. My knowledge, I do believe to start off with like the oxygen that you're mentioning. But for that 100 that you mentioned, one thing I do really like about Dr. Bob and Bill W. is their open mindedness to crossing racial barriers, gender barriers. So out of curiosity, out of that 100 that you mentioned, how many were Afro-American or women?
In this first 100, I think we've got maybe 3 or 4 women. I don't know. There isn't any notation about anybody being African-American. But given the fact that it's 1939, I doubt that we've got any African-American members coming in yet. How many people here ever listen to XA Radio? Or, I mean, XA... speakers.org. There's a website, it's called xa-speakers.org. There is a great treasure called on there. There's a guy by the name of Barry L. The talks in Montreal in 1980. And it's to the first gay and lesbian meeting at an international convention. And in it, he tells the story because he was the guy at the door when Veronica, which is, they called him Veronica because he was wearing the blonde wig, the African-American transsexual, or not transsexual, but cross-dressing junkie alcoholic shows up. And he's there, and he tells the story about what that whole thing and how it came down. And it's a lovely story. But the punchline in it is, they call Bill up, and he goes through this litany. It's a guy, and he's like, argh. And Bill says, "Is he alcoholic?" And the guy says, "Clearly." He says, "That's the only question we can answer."
Well, that's the beauty of the traditions, right? And Bill pushed very hard for the traditions, and they weren't welcome because it was changing. But if you think about how we're all here today, because the only requirement for AA is a desire to stop drinking. You don't even have to stop drinking to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or a lot of us wouldn't be here because it took a while. But that came from forged wisdom based on many mistakes, like much of the traditions. If you read why they're there, it's because they tried the opposite and it didn't work. I'm sorry.
There's a great story, too, about Wilson went to a prison and... out of that prison, there's a couple of black guys there that he invited to the meeting. They show up, and the rest of the guys in the meeting didn't want him in there. And they took a vote and voted not to have them be in the meeting. So Wilson, in his brilliance, goes back into the room. He takes the guys out, puts them in the kitchen, goes back in the room, and he says, "Let's take another vote whether black people should have the program. Should they have the program like we do?" And they all voted, "Well, of course." And he goes, "Great, I'm going to bring them in as observers so they can carry it to their community." Yeah. And he brought them in. I love that story. That's Wilson.
Yes, sir.
Talking about the third tradition,
somebody who wants to join the group that absolutely, you know, it freaks everybody out. They'll say, no, we cannot have this person, and this person is so afflicted that they would even bring us all down and all that. And I've heard different versions. I've heard that it was maybe Marty Mann, who was a lesbian, and then I heard that there was a transvestite who...
This one's in Akron also. This one's in Akron. Veronica's in New York. And the reason I mentioned Veronica is that we've got a guy that was there telling the story about this type of thing. The story that's in the 12 and 12 is from Akron. And that's the one where Bob says, and again, it's he's a sex deviant. Homosexual. Not one that could pass. I mean, it's that bad. And so... there's this whole thing, and there's a whole. We just this past it'll be available on it'll be available for you to download the whole conference, the 2016 conference, for $20. But we had a woman give a talk on the first LGBTQ members of. Alcoholics Anonymous, and she tells, you know, that she went through this very weird thing where they're talking about how the whole thing in those days was being able to pass. That's the only way you could survive. But there were some people that just were, they couldn't pass. And this guy that showed up in Akron was somebody that couldn't pass. And he said, Bob, I'm a sex deviant, not only that, I'm a drug addict, and you know, and so they went through this thing, and you know, they're going to have the vote, and Bob says, after everybody, it's really clear that they're going to boot this guy out, and then Bob lays the line on him. Well, what would the master do? And everybody goes, well, they're going to let him in, of course, you know. So that's the, yeah.
Well, isn't it true they didn't want women in originally because the men would sleep with them?
Well, no, that was Bob.
It was Bob.
Bob Smith is the guy who said, behind every skirt there's a slip.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was not interested in it being open to women.
And we all know that the truth is the men aren't safe because now there's women in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my experience.
I've heard you before, and I just wonder if we had time. You would tell the story of your spiritual experience that Dr. Bob tells. And I have a question that I've always wanted to ask, and I don't know who else to ask, because I'd like to know if it's true or if it's apocryphal. But I read somewhere that Bill had gone to Ohio and had said, I think, to Clarence Snyder and to Bob about that he wanted to see why the program seemed to be, more people seemed to be staying sober in Ohio than were staying sober in New York. And what I read was that Clarence Snyder said to Bill, it's because in Ohio, the program is trust God, clean house, and help others, and in New York, the program is don't drink and go to meetings. And I have personal experience with a lot of don't drink and go to meetings. It didn't work so well. I always wanted to know if that was true.
I think that really the, if you take a look at it, everybody that comes in Akron just about is going through a hospital with a doctor. It gives an entirely different credence than the guys that are doing stuff at Clinton Street. It's an entirely different thing. They came up with a medical protocol. People are coming from all over for that. It's a medical deal. In New York, they don't have that. And that's why the skew. I mean, the Prince of the 12-Steppers, they showed up at his work, for Christ's sakes. You know, I mean, we can get into all that structure of the meeting, what that had to do with it. But the primary documents that I have about the structure of the meetings and what they were doing with people in New York in 1938, 1939, they're getting them down on their knees there, too. You know, but it's not, that's not part of the popular thing. You know, it's this... Dr. Bob's been hijacked by a bunch of people that had an agenda. And he was a much more open-minded person than than he's given credit for. But I think it's really medical protocol more than anything.
We had a patient man waiting here. Go ahead.
This is an honest question. Is AA still growing? I tracked, they published, and of course they're only estimates, the General Service Office of Inventories in the 90s, in the early part of the century. The numbers were flat for at least 10 years, or so, 2 million, and it stopped.
Yeah.
And I wondered.
Yeah, okay, so the answer is absolutely. You, sir, appear to be part of a generation of people that came through. They had three generations of alcoholics that, if they had insurance, all got swept into AA simultaneously. It's a tsunami that will never, ever happen again. You will never have that kind of a peak. You won't have it, number one. Number two, personally, my experience is, especially internationally, that Cocaine Anonymous is incredibly effective. And people that would have been that were coming to AA in the early and mid-80s, they've got their own separate fellowship now. So, I mean, yeah, it's flat, but you've got another 15 maybe anonymous groups that have started up.
Well, in our home group, the Monday Night Men's Stag in Hermosa Beach, when I joined the home group, the median age was, what, 40 maybe or 35?
Yeah, 40.
And it was 100 people roughly. Since I joined, a couple of groups have taken big chunks out of the meeting out of resentment, which we find perfectly fine and we will discuss later. But they go start their own meetings, and now the median age is in the 20s.
Absolutely.
Easy, because we have teenagers. So that's how things grow, right? The youth. And there was, you know, there's a lot of reasons that happened, but these guys are carrying the message like nobody's business, you know. And you met one of them. If you met Josh when he was out here before, he came in very young.
And 18.
Came to our group with that influx of youth, and they took over our damn meeting.
I'm just glad they let me still come.
Yeah. We have to send him money sometimes. Yeah. We have to underwrite his seat.
I lost the war. Man. Yeah.
Let Bill in.
You know, the other thing that you have to consider when you're looking at the statistics that come out of New York, you really have to look at how the census is compiled. Structurally, how do they actually do it? One of the things, and there's a great report, you know, the recovery statistics that I'd be happy to send you. If you're really that interested, you can pore over it, and it's very enlightening. It's hard to get through because it's statistics, you know. What they did twice is they changed the basis for gathering the numbers. Well, as you know, as anybody that went to school knows, if you've changed it, you just start over now. Because you've changed how it's compiled, and they've done that twice. If you take that and you combine it with the number of 12-step programs, dependent upon what list you look at, it's 150, 200, maybe even 300 different 12-step programs now. You look at Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, you know, there's Heroin Anonymous now that's very big in Phoenix. You know, I spoke at their fundraiser for their first international convention. They filled this hall. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And the reason for it is a couple of guys from AA started this thing because they'd go into prisons, they'd say the AA meeting's here, and nobody would come. So one of them got a bright idea, being creative as we are, you know. He walks in, he goes, we're Heroin Anonymous. They filled the room. Yeah.
You know? These guys were 60 years old that started this.
Yes, over 30, 35 years sober. Jan Black's husband and another guy. And so they started having meetings on the outside for when these guys get out, they could come to meetings, right? And you're not talking about the old line heroin addict, the guy that's sleeve tattooed from head to toe, and he's a biker and he's a gangster. These are kids. These are children. You know,
fun-loving criminals.
Yeah, fun-loving criminals with tattoos, and right. You know, but it's not the same kind of heroin addict that I grew up with. You know, so we've addressed the marketplace. Now there would have been a time where all of these guys would be trying to assimilate into Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think if you want to see the growth in recovery from addictive diseases, you have to look at the entire thing. If you look at the entire thing, it's gone through the roof, the number of people that are in recovery.
Well, and I don't want to open this can of worms too wide, but, you know, there's been some articles lately in psychology magazines about the effectiveness of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I work in medicine, and I work in clinical trials. I study clinical trials for my job. And the only thing I have to say about those articles is, first of all, they're written with the person who has the agenda, that therapy's more successful than AA. And secondly, how many people have been to a therapist only once and didn't do anything they said? So I wonder if they lumped them into the statistical group, right? So if we went around in the street and said, have you been to an AA meeting? Lots and lots of people might say yes. And they go, are you still sober? No, okay, AA doesn't work, AA doesn't work, AA doesn't work, AA. Well, did you stay for 3 months and get a sponsor and work all 12 steps? That's a different statistical analysis. Then do they include every single person that went to one therapy session, didn't do anything they said? I doubt it. I think they include somebody who went through that. So I think we don't get into that controversy. The proof that AA works is right here.
Well, and I gotta lay another thing on this just because I have experience. Sorry. One of the things I do is I go to the International. When I go to the International, one of the things I do is I go to different meetings that have different things. And medicine in AA is always a fascinating one. And at this latest one in Atlanta, they had Dr. Leonard Blumenthal give a presentation on the MATCH study. And the MATCH study has been going on now for 25 years. Statistically, double-blind thing. And they have proven that 12-step recovery is superior to any other form of
therapy,
whatever. And we're talking about the high priced analysis that only a few people can get. So, I mean, we've got the numbers, but as a membership, we're not aware of that. We just hear the stuff from the outside.
Thank you. They have no idea how many meetings there are, much less how many people are in AA. I'm telling you, they have no idea when you study how they compile the census.
Up here.
You know, it always intrigued me, you know,
I'm sorry.
One for a certain amount of days or months or whatever. I mean, was there at any time where they thought that they should maybe put a time limit on how long it's been like?
Okay, interesting question. The question is there any data that in the old days that people worked steps more quickly or any prescribed thing? No. Not only that, the guy who wrote the steps said the steps are only to be taken in whatever order and however many is between that man and his God. I think he should be fired. Kick him out right now. You're killing alcoholics. How do you say that? I got the letter.
But that's always brings up, whenever I hear somebody at an AA meeting say, well, I worked the steps. I could do a lot of jail and prison work now, right? Because I was trying to get connected. I worked ED, past tense, the steps. I immediately discount whatever comes out of their mouth next. Because I've read this literature, and throughout the steps, this is a lifetime job. This is goes on forever. It's not like you work the steps. The steps is a dynamic thing. You know, we're still sitting here. I'm going to do a fifth step with him on May 16th, right? It's in the books. And these steps are, if you want to evolve spiritually, you don't stop, you know, following the map. So that's just my two cents about that. I was getting kind of turned off by that.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, in the beginning, what they consider a failure would be, like, someone, a dry drunk, as we say.
No. It was somebody that had left the meetings and they knew was drinking. Okay, so there's one. One was still sober. We know where they are. Two was after a few slips, had come back and stuck. Three was what they called a failure. Now, also lumped in the failure of the 100 people, there were 17 that were missing. So they counted them as a failure because they weren't connected. Any other, Brent? I've got three different lists, one from Bill Wilson, one from Akron in Dr. Bob's hand, and the other one from Chicago, the pre-1940, that shows the names and the sobriety dates of the people.
He's just wondering where the myth of the 78 came from.
Oh. Certain AA historians have been known to say it. Yeah. Yeah, this is called making amends at a public level. No, it's true. I mean, I can't tell you how much over the years that as I've gone further and further into the primary documents, I've found out that some of the things that I was most vociferous about, you know, and that I was very, very clear about from the data that I could collect, none of which, though, was primary document, that there's another one that's this thing about Bill being a womanizer. It's a canard. There's nothing to it. The man had a mistress. Do you know what a mistress is? I didn't know because I'm a feminist. I always thought it was a bad word. It's a long-term love affair with somebody other than your spouse that is known by all parties. This idea that when Bill went out, there was an old-timers watch that watched him, it comes from one guy. And you can follow the evidence to find out where it came from. And it's just not true.
You know, part of where the 78 came from is Bill and Bob sat down and made a list, a handwritten list, of people that they knew that were sober or questionable or the one, twos, and threes. And they came up with 45 names. And they got really excited by that. Like, this thing is working now. This was early on.
1936.
Yeah. And so from the 78 that you're asking the question, where did that come from? Well, a lot of people knew about that list. I think probably just added a few more as time had gone on because they wrote that preface in 39 to the first edition. You know, so when he says that there was 100, it just automatically took exception to that. Somebody came up and said, there weren't 100. I've heard 78, I've heard 72, you know, but I repeated it too for a long time. You know, I made kind of a joke out of it. The Bill was a promoter, you know. And when I heard that, I was there at that presentation too, and I talked to the guy for a long time afterwards. He actually found that handwritten list by Bill and Bob in a box in somebody's attic. Wow. You know, he found the original list. You should have seen how thrilled when he told the story. Yeah. He was like a little kid in the candy store. He pulls out and he goes, oh, my God! Here it is, you know.
And then he didn't tell the guy whose box it was because he... said, oh, this is interesting. Can I have a copy?
So, you know, I mean, it came out of, somebody pulled it out of their butt.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's a broad question, but I guess I've always gotten the sense from people I've talked to that the program's changed a lot. That's not, it makes a lot of sense in terms of meeting. But I also hear from different people that people work the steps differently. Whether that be very quickly or all in the day. And I tend to get a sense that there used to be this very pure program and then we're ruining it every day since.
Yeah.
Now,
We have not grown in effectiveness and understanding since Clarence Snyder quit working with people in Cleveland.
Yeah. He's kidding.
But this is a sense of it, and I guess I want to get an idea of how real is that? Obviously, a lot of that's profitable, but has how people work the program changed in the last?
Well, that's what I'm sorry. That's what this whole thing is about.
Yeah.
is about the difference in the way that we were given the program and how we've gone about more in a unified way sharing it, but we each with our own flavor. But this is, I'm very much a third edition guy. I was given the program before the hospital programs were telling us what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I was there with the reaction to that. When we're in meetings, staying sober, and a guy comes in and says, I've been in this hospital, and they told me I got 5 years worth of sobriety, information of sobriety. And that's what they were sent out into the meetings with. But back to the people have worked the steps in a day. I took 3 weeks to get going. But it was a different time in a different era. We were busy working with drunks. We didn't have time to spend a lot of time on self-reflection. This whole idea of self-examination and the way we know it today was, I mean, a fifth step. I mean, one of the reasons why the Catholic Church was very, very hesitant about supporting Alcoholics Anonymous was it was people hearing confession who were not qualified to hear it. Now, this is I mean, psychology's out, but it's not stuff that you're learning about in school and the like. People are talking about things that had never been spoken about openly in society. So,
well, and you know, the wisdom of the founders and the humility of this promoter we keep bagging on was we realize we know only a little. More will be revealed. Right? That's wisdom, because they had watched what happened and knew they weren't responsible for the whole thing. And Bob Bazance answered this question. Basically, your question is, has AA lost its edge, right? And we addressed that last time we were here. And if you didn't, it was 7 years ago. Get the tapes. We talk a lot about that. But one of the things that he said that I think is so perfect is he said, you know, beware of orthodoxy and Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing that keeps Alcoholics Anonymous honest is alcohol. As long as there are people dying of alcoholism, there has to be some place to go to recover. And we are all sitting in this room a long time after this program was founded. And I can say without unequivocally, I am in pure recovery. Right? And I'm in, and Josh, who's 20 years younger than me, is in pure recovery. That's available because it's needed. And if you have that feeling that it's losing its edge. Be the change you want to see, but we go all over the world, and believe me, there are strong AA soldiers everywhere.
Okay. And we can send you the statistical stuff about this. I mean, it's really so. But let's. This guy's been has.
Oh,
and then
sorry.
We'll get to you.
Yeah.
What are the origins of the Akron Manual, and why is it not such a prominent piece of literature that's readily available as
Well, that's
a question.
That's a really question. Okay. The question is, why is it that the Akron Manual is not? Is this a plant, JG? Readily available piece of literature, and as like the 12 and 12 is, or why? So, how many people have heard of the Akron Manual? Pull it out, big guy.
I got it.
Okay. Bill's going to do about 5 minutes. I'll do a little setup for you. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous comes out. Akron had nothing to do with the writing of the Big Book. How's that for a little controversy?
It's a New York deal, and they didn't like those
and they didn't like it. They didn't want any part of it. Any part of it. The book comes out. Bob takes a look at it and says, it's not going to help the blue-collared man. We need something. So he gets his friend Ernie, his fishing buddy, to write a few things. And they were called the Akron Manual. And why don't you do that, and I'll do spiritual milestones. Okay?
So
this is written, this is the Akron response to the Big Book. And it's still available. You can get it online from the Akron Intergroup. You can Google it online, but give money to the Akron Intergroup because they need it, and they're really good people. Okay? And so this is what they were doing as opposed to the Big Book. One of the things people ask about sponsorship, it's not in the book. Or, you know, It's because the book was designed for people that couldn't have sponsors.
Okay. 1940, 1941?
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay, these are just excerpts from the Rackham Manual. You might get a kick out of this, but...
Thanks.
It says here, explain that we are not in the business of sobering up drunks merely to have them go on another bender. Explain that our aim is total and permanent sobriety. There's never any mention of one day at a time in this thing. Definition of an alcoholic anonymous. An alcoholic anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application of and adherence to the rules laid down by the organization, has completely forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages. The moment he wittingly takes a drink so much as a drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic drink, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
What about kombucha? Yeah.
AA is not AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain completely sober at all times. To the newcomer, it is your life, it is your choice. If you are not completely convinced to your own satisfaction that you are an alcoholic, that your life has become unmanageable, if you are not ready to part with alcohol forever, it would be better for all concerned if you discontinue reading this and give up the idea of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're out, loser. You'll love this, ladies.
To the ladies.
Which are very separate from the guy. Different kinds of alcoholics, evidently. Now, if we seem to slight you in this booklet, it is not intentional. We merely use the masculine pronouns he and him for convenience. We fully realize that alcohol shows no partiality. It does not respect age, sex, nor estate. The millionaire drunk on the best scotch and the poor man drunk on the cheapest rot gut look like twin brothers when they are in a hospital bed or the gutter. The only difference between a female and male drunk is that the former is likely to be treated with a little more consideration and courtesy, although generally she does not deserve it.
Get in the car.
Every word in this pamphlet applies to women as well as men. A word to the sponsor. You must fulfill all pledges you make to him, either tangible or intangible. If you cannot fulfill a promise, do not make it. You have in your hands the most valuable property in the world, the future of a fellow man. Treat his life as carefully as you would your own. You are literally responsible for his life. That's pretty heavy. Alcoholics Anonymous is 100% effective for those who faithfully follow the rules. It is those who try to cut corners who find themselves back in their old drunken state. Before long, you will have a new thrill, the thrill of helping someone else. There is no greater satisfaction in the world than watching the progress of a new Alcoholic Anonymous. No whiskey in the world can give you this thrill. Above all, remember this. Keep the rules in mind. As long as you follow them, you are on firm ground, but the least deviation and you are vulnerable. Big about rules and structure. As a new member, remember that you are one of the most important cogs in the machinery of AA. Without the work of the new member, AA could not have grown as it has. You will bring into this work a fresh enthusiasm, the zeal of a crusader. You will want everyone to share with you the blessings of this new life. You will be tireless in your efforts to help others, and it is a splendid enthusiasm. Cherish it as long as you can. For you are ready to sponsor some other poor alcoholic who is desperately in need of help, both human and divine. So God bless you and keep you. I love this one. This next one is very, very good. You aren't very important in this world. If you lose your job, someone better will replace you. If you die, your wife will mourn briefly and then remarry. Your children will grow up and you will be but a memory. In the last analysis, you are the only one who benefits by your sobriety. Seek to cultivate humility. Remember that cockiness leads to a speedy fall. So you can tell they were already having trouble with this stuff. Medical men will tell you that alcoholics are all alike, at least in at least one respect. They are emotionally immature. In other words, alcoholics have not learned to think like adults. At meetings, don't criticize the leader. He has his own problems and is doing his best to solve them. Help him along by standing up and saying a few words. He will appreciate your kindness and thoughtfulness. Don't criticize the methods of others. Strangely enough, you may change your own ideas as you become older in sobriety. Remember, there are a dozen roads from New York to Chicago, but they all land in Chicago. How soon you will be cured of a desire to drink is another matter. That depends entirely upon how quickly you can succeed in changing your fundamental outlook on life. For as your outlook changes for the better, desire will become less pronounced until it disappears almost entirely. It may be weeks, it may be months. Your sincerity and your capacity for working with others on the AA program will determine the length of time. So they don't say working the steps. It's working with others. That's what they were doing. They weren't working steps like we do. My father got sober in 1954 in Los Angeles, and he never wrote an inventory. He never made amends, not like we do. That isn't what they were doing.
And it wasn't what they were doing when I came in.
Yeah. It wasn't until around that time in the 70s, 80s, where this whole emphasis on the books started. These groups like the Denver Young People's Group, you know, came out of Denver, and the Primary Purpose guys now, and a lot of these other groups, you know. I mean, this is what it's all about. Even the Pacific Group, they're not really big in steps, you know. I mean, they do it. They do the work, but they're not book thumpers, you know. And what we have now is like really breaking this thing down and working it. And I think for the most part, it's better. The 12 steps. Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a set of laws known as the 12 steps. Years of experience have definitely proved that those who live up to these rules remain sober. Those who gloss over or ignore any one rule are in constant danger of returning to a life of drunkenness. Thousands of words could be written on each rule. Lack of space prevents, so they are merely listed here. It is suggested that they be explained by a sponsor. If he cannot explain them, he should provide someone who can. That's little excerpts from the Akron Manual.
So these guys are like, this is not a vision for you. You know, this is not promises. This is like, work it, and if you don't, you're going to die, and we don't really care because there'll be another person in the chair. And so this is the message that was coming from Akron. And it's, but another thing along those lines is there's another part of these, the Akron pamphlets. There's five of them. Two of them are blended here. There's another one on how to speak at a meeting. We never use that because it says never talk over 20 minutes. So we never use that pamphlet at all. We've grown past that. But there's one called Spiritual Milestones in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, again, this is the Akron response to the big book. And the entire pamphlet up until the end is really good mid-19th century Christian consciousness, because that's where these guys all came from. But at the end, when they're finishing, they're talking about that all ethical religions practice the same precepts that are in the 12 steps. Example, and this is from Akron in 1940-1941. Followers of Muhammad are taught to help the poor, give shelter to the homeless and the traveler, and to conduct themselves with personal dignity. Consider the 8-part program laid down in Buddhism. Right view. Right aim, right speech, right action. right living, right effort, right mindedness, and right contemplation. The Buddhist philosophy, as exemplified by these 8 points, could literally be adopted by AA as a substitute for or an addition to the 12 steps. Generosity, universal love, and welfare of others rather than the considerations of self are what is important. Now, if I would say that in my home group, hey, I just got done reading the Upanishads. I got done reading the Dhammapada, and I think that the Eightfold Path could be a substitute for the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. How quickly would they burn me at the stake? This is from Akron, and this is from Dr. Bob and his four best friends, the oldest guys at the time. So when we think about, well, it was a Christian program, that's not what Bob was doing. He relied on the good book, but his son Smitty said that he was interested in all kinds of stuff. And if you take a look at the library and the books that he was reading Ouspensky, he was reading the Dhammapada, he was reading all kinds of stuff, looking to get a spiritual experience like Bill had.
We should. Okay. One more question, and we're going to move on to the next one. Go ahead.
All right. I mean, I only have 6 years sober, but I'm not saying I agree with everything in the Akron Manual that Bill read. But it seems to me, when I hear, like, that direct approach, I know I'm 6 years sober, I've grown a lot, but when I hear the direct approach, it's more effective. I'm not saying I agree with everything they're saying there, but I like that direct approach. I like the fact that...
That's why guys with six...
It's death or life. And I think that's, to me, what is missing. To me,
It's not missing because you're carrying it. Right. That's why the guys and gals between 2 and 8 years sober are the best sponsors. Because that's the consciousness. Come on, man. We can do it.
But I'll tell you something about that, Eric. That's a good point. Is, you know, one of the things that I take umbrage at is when I go to meetings and I hear people say, my sponsor thumped me in the chest and called me stupid. Because I've read this book a number of times, and it repeatedly tells you not to do that. Over and over again. And it's because they tried it, and people died. I tried it, and people died. So I want to counter that and tell you a little story, because I'd rather give you my experience and my opinion. I had a guy that had to come live with me because he was dying of alcoholism. His liver was gone, and he had nowhere to go. He couldn't go back home because every couple of weeks, drug dealers came and beat him up till he gave him money for stuff he didn't get. And he lived in my trailer. And I'd go out there, and I'd read the book with him and do my morning meditation with him. And at night, I'd come and take him, put him in the car, and we'd go to meetings. And he started waking up a little and getting brighter, and I thought, man, I'm really having an impact on this guy. A huge impact on this guy. And then one day, he's going to move out from my trailer in my driveway. And before he left, he goes, I need to talk to you. And I go, okay. And he goes, hey, in the morning, it's important before you leave for work that you do the dishes, because Philippa can't do the dishes, and I do the dishes. In the afternoon, we vacuum and mop and sweep, and we make the beds. And Philippa has only got one hand. You may want to help her with that. And sometimes she needs help chopping stuff up for dinner at night. What was helping Mike was not me and all the bullshit coming out of my mouth, but he became part of something where he could contribute and help and be loved and cared about, and he wanted to live in it. So I never thumped that guy on the chest and called him stupid, and I mistakenly thought I was raising him from the dead. And it was my wife saying, Mike, mop. Mike, can you cut the vegetables? And, you know, that's why we're here, kind of, because we don't want to tell you our experience at just 3 years and 5 years and 6 years. This has never stopped revealing itself. Just, we call each other all the time and go, dude, you won't believe what just happened.
Yeah, we do.
And you won't believe what we just found out I was wrong about, right?
Yeah.
Sandy Beach is big about that. This is a constant revelation of what you're wrong about. So you're perfect where you're supposed to be. You are going to help people that we wouldn't help right now. But I like that your approach to the question was open-mindedness. So we actually want to get into the fruits of sponsorship.
Right.
You guys need a break. Yeah. All right.